Hello and welcome to Cranfield University. In this interview series, we explore the role of philosophy and humanities more broadly for management, engineering, but also for our everyday lives. My name is Andrei Pavlov, and I'm Professor of Strategy and Performance here at the School of Management.
And I'm Toby Thompson. I'm the Studio Director here at Cranfield, and my interest is in Heidegger and executive education and the whole continental philosophy theme.
And our guest today is Professor Halvard Lillehammer, Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck, University of London. Halvard, welcome. Welcome to Cranfield.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Halvard, could I just open this conversation in a slightly unconventional way? I definitely have a few questions about your background and kind of your research interests in philosophy. But could I start by asking about the course in philosophy for business students that you taught at Cambridge University and then at Birkbeck. This is something that we are doing at Cranfield as well, and this is extremely interesting to us, to both me and Toby. And I'm dying to know or to ask you about the about your experience of doing this. How did it come about? What's it like, and what's the thinking behind it?
Well, the way that the course that I've been teaching recently works is that it's meant to supply you with a conceptual critical toolkit to think about issues that arise when you work in an institution such as a bank, but not necessarily a commercial institution. It could be a public institution. And so we start with the idea that there are certain kinds of questions that we need to ask that are, if you like, normative or evaluative, because we have rules and regulations and structures that we work within, but they're always flexible and they're malleable, and we have to apply rules within them, and we have to exercise a judgment when we do so. And sometimes we disagree with the rules and the regulations and the norms. And so we find that ethics is everywhere. And then most of the course is taken up focusing on certain kinds of questions that arise ethically when we work in institutions, and gives a kind of a way to think about those critically. So we think about concepts like integrity, truthfulness, manipulation, trust, trustworthiness, and so on and so forth. And what the course aims to do is to give the student a way to think about what kind of assumptions that are embodied in how institutions employ those concepts, how they're understood in people's lives when they work within institutions, to give people a conception of what alternative ways there are of thinking about those concepts, how to apply them to cases, to examples. And then towards the end of that course, although it happens, as it were, by application throughout, we raise some of the big questions. So we take some of the big sort of, we might call them ideological or principled claims about the justification of, say, a market system, and say, look, now we have this conceptual toolkit. Let's look at some of those arguments and see what assumptions they make about those kinds of concepts, and see how good those arguments are at the end of the day. And the thought is that the students will now have some of the resources to do that in a slightly more intelligent way or slightly more articulated way than they did before. So it's really a way of helping the students to acquire a vocabulary, a taxonomy, a set of concepts to do the critical thinking that they probably do anyway, but perhaps at the end of the course with a little bit more conceptual texture and sophistication.
And these are business students, or what's their background? What sort of degree are they pursuing?
Well, so I've been teaching students with various backgrounds for this type of course. When we taught it at Cambridge University, it was first MBA students who took this course as an elective. Then it was executive MBA students who took it again as an elective. At Birkbeck, it's been a mixed set of students. Some of them have been humanities students. Some of them have been management students, people who do degrees in management or accountancy. Philosophy students, both graduates and undergraduates, and so a wide variety of people's of backgrounds. Some people are professionals who do philosophy, as it were, on the side. Some people are not professionals. And that's quite important, certainly the way the course has developed, because it's quite clear that the idea of developing this conceptual toolkit for how to think about your ethical place in an institution is something that has quite a broad application. And so depending on who the students are at any given time, you can adjust, perhaps by thinking of what examples to use, the discussion to the kind of institutional environment that the students are more familiar with. So some classes, it'll be a very commercial environment. In some cases, it'll be a very high-powered environment. For example, you're dealing with an executive MBA class. But in another class, it might be students who don't have so much experience, say, with the business world or of high levels of management, in which case you can apply this conceptual toolkit to their experiences. Mm.
And so what are some of the tools in that toolkit? What are you hoping to equip them with?
Well, I mean, a good example of something that is very topical these days is manipulation, and to what extent should we be worried about, as it were, the fact that we live in this high-tech culture in which there are machines that run algorithms that we're not aware of, that decide what we see when we go on our YouTube feed, or that decide what we do when we go on Google, that decide what kind of news we get to find out what happens around in the world. So we ask ourselves, to what extent does this interfere with the idea that we are freely choosing things, that we are in charge of our own information search, that we are in charge of making our own decisions, that we are autonomous agents who, as it were, develop our ethical or professional sensibility in a way that is somehow under our control. Mm-hmm. So one thing that the philosophical toolkit can provide you with is a set of different ways of understanding what autonomy, freedom, choice consists in, and how, depending on what kind of model you choose to think about it, it will or will not be more or less true or more or less problematic to say that you're choosing or deciding to find out something freely.
Mm. And how do the students respond to this? And how do you actually then, I suppose, two questions in one. How do you bring this this machinery of kind of philosophical ideas and concepts into the lectures, into the classroom? Do you ask the students to read philosophy? Do you provide lectures? So that's one side of the question. And the other side of the question is, well, so what's the reaction? What's the response? What do you get back from them?
Well, I mean, so I think there are three questions there. So what's the mode of delivery first? Well, normally what we'll do is we'll do a combination of lecture and discussion in a seminar. Mm-hmm. Normally there'll be some reading. It could be a piece of very theoretical philosophical reading, or it could be something a little bit more applied. But certainly in most recent years, there's always been some academic article that presents a certain point of view. In terms of how the students respond, I think the interesting thing about this topic, which is not unique to this topic, it's common in philosophy, is that students will have different reactions. And so it's not usually very difficult to generate, say, an example that where you can apply this particular question to a real world case and ask people's opinions about it. And normally in a class, one can elicit people's responses and find a variety of views. And then you can spend some time in the class asking the people, as it were, on each side of a question, why they have the view that they have. And they will then be able to explain in the words that we've decided to operate with, why they think that, for example, something is a problematic form of manipulation, or why they think it's not a problematic form of manipulation. I mean, give you a classic example in terms of advertising, for example, which is something I always talk about in every class on this course. Some people might think that there is something deeply problematic in which, by means of which, customers are always being manipulated in advertising, particularly because there are these messages that, as it were, are not explicit. And then some students might say, well, actually, you know, most communications have various aspects to them that are not made explicit. So does that mean all communication is manipulative? And then we can have a discussion about that, thinking about different kinds of cases, some from advertising and some not from advertising, and see how it goes. I mean, the aim in a philosophy class is normally not to keep them in the room and not let them leave until they've all signed that they agree with a certain proposition. But, you know, occasionally there is a drift towards a certain view, and sometimes there isn't.
And just last question.
Go on.
I know Toby's dying to ask you all sorts of questions. But last question, I suppose, from me. So what do you think, on a broad scale, what do you think the students get out of this course?
Well, I guess you have to ask them. But I think what they might get out of this course is the ability to think about questions that many of them will have thought about already, because they are all students who select to do this course. They're not forced to do this course, but to do so in a way that allows them to articulate their thoughts, and perhaps their thoughts that they now have that they didn't have before, with a vocabulary and a set of sort of theoretical constructions that allows them to be a little bit more articulate and sophisticated in giving a reason for why they believe the things that they believe. I mean, at the end of the class, at the end of the course, you might have a discussion with someone outside university about the same topic as you had with them the year before. And the hope would be that the way you carry on that conversation might be slightly different at the end of it than it was at the beginning. That's one thing you can achieve. I think it's not particularly realistic to think that you will achieve having sold them a particular political or philosophical ideology. That's not really part of the course.
Yeah, but hopefully that's what the aim,
I do think people change their minds about things, and you do get student feedback, or you do get students writing to us afterwards saying that they've actually used some of the thinking that they've come across in the course of their work, and it has helped them and sometimes allowed them to do things that they didn't do before.
Toby.
Halvard, I'm intrigued about you, and I guess those people that are watching and thinking, well, I could do what Halvard is doing. That's easy, just asking a bunch of questions. What's your background? How did you come to this?
So my background is in moral and political philosophy. So I was brought up in the so-called Anglophone tradition of philosophy, which meant that I read mainly contemporary, but also some historical writers on this topic. So what I'm familiar with is, certain types of theories about how you justify how society is constructed, how you justify the existence of certain institutions, such as markets or public services, how you apply those theories to certain kinds of cases, for example, in the ethics of the professions. For example, how do you justify that in some parts of professions, when some people are doing well, necessarily other people will do badly? The ethics for adversaries, as it's called in a book by Brian Applebaum. So I have that theoretical background, and before I started teaching students who study business and professions like that, I had some experience working in biomedical ethics. So I was working with people in the late 90s and early noughties, in when the big topic was the genome. Mm-hmm. And so I have some experience talking to people, as it were, across disciplinary boundaries or from academia to outside academia about how abstract ideas that we theorize in philosophy have applications in institutions. So I was familiar with the idea of ethics and ethics in institutions. But until I taught students on the MBA in Cambridge, I had never taught business students before. So for me, that was a question of adapting a certain way of thinking about how philosophy could be applied to a new kind of profession or a new kind of institutional context.
I'm intrigued by your notion of indifference, because you've written papers on indifference and maybe indifference as a virtue. How are you expecting people to come to your conversations? Because I guess indifference is, I don't know. Or is indifference something more than that?
Well, so when it comes to that particular topic, one of the things that we try to bring to the students' attention is the idea that in professions, or actually in most walks of life, we cultivate certain dispositions which in a certain context might be thought to be a very bad one, but in another context might be necessary. And so we are, as it were, engaging in a certain kind of internal ethical division of labor. So if you think about the fact that in order to perform a certain type of task, well, you have to concentrate on it. And in order to concentrate on that task, you have to block out other things that you don't concentrate on, because otherwise you won't do your task well. And that means that in that context, you are indifferent to those things you're blocking out. And that might be not just a virtue, it might be a necessary thing for you to be able to perform your job well. Let me give you an example from yesterday, as I watched some sport on TV. Somebody was taking a penalty kick in a football match. Imagine taking a penalty kick in a football match in front of the opposing supporters, and they're shouting abuse at you, right? Now, of course, it's possible that somebody might take that to be a motivating feature of scoring the penalty. But another way of thinking about it is that you just block out all that negativity in order to concentrate on scoring your goal. So you're cultivating a certain set of indifference to it in that situation. And that might be an absolutely essential thing to do, to concentrate on doing your task. Similarly, in professions, in business, in order to concentrate on your task, you have to block certain things out in order to realize your ends. But the problem, of course, is that has a flip side, because if you concentrate on it exclusively, you might actually miss out on certain kinds of things in your environment that you should be aware of. And then you might end up in a state which is not a virtue, it's a bad state, which I call blinkered indifference, where you basically don't take account of certain kinds of relevant features of the environment in which you find yourselves, because you're so concentrating on realizing the means to your ends. And this is a topic which, I mean, philosophers haven't, in my tradition, haven't really historically theorized to a great extent, but philosophers in other traditions on the continent and people in sociology and other parts of the social sciences have been very aware of this fact, that this kind of what I call blinkered indifference has seriously difficult and pernicious effects. And of course, when you think about teaching students in a business context who perhaps want to or are already work in the professions, the obvious example to think about there is profit chasing. Profits chasing for the sake of it, profit chasing at the cost of anything, and regardless of what the collateral damages of doing so. So the notion of indifference, as it were, and how it's cultivated intelligently or not intelligently, sits straight in the middle of what I think of as core business ethics.
So I'm linking impartiality to indifference, or indifference to impartiality, and then possibly onward to objectivity. And I'm thinking of Thomas Nagel, of course, the view from nowhere. Would you ascribe to Nagel's view that there is such a thing as the view from nowhere?
No, I don't subscribe to his conception of the view from nowhere, or the idea of what Bernard Williams' alternative called an absolute conception of the world. But I do subscribe to the idea that what those philosophers have provided us with is a model for thinking about how we can detach more or less from a particular point in time or a particular subjective or time relative point of view on the world, and that sometimes we not only are encouraged to, but we need to do so in order to see the world from a slightly, as it were, more impartial or more universal or more less historically specific standpoint. And this can be a very important and a good thing to do, but also, of course, it can sometimes be a problematic thing.
Is this connected to the notion of, as I'm bringing it back, I suppose, to managers and organizations? Is it connected to the notion of moral muteness that I know you talk about in your class as well?
Yes, I think one way of thinking about the notion of moral muteness, which is not my term, is that it arises when people are encouraged to pursue a certain kind of maybe blinkered indifference, perhaps through profit chasing or perhaps through a certain competitive spirit in a team, so at the exclusion of certain other things which not only are ethically significant, such as the effects you have on others who may not have chosen to be in that situation, so there might be the innocent bystanders, but also at the cost of what you're really thinking and feeling. So one of the curious things about the notion of moral muteness is the phenomenon where someone is actually motivated in ways that are not indifferent or hostile to people around them. Perhaps someone is motivated to help someone, but because the environment they find themselves in is very competitive, they're encouraged to, as it were, suppress that fact or not communicate that fact. So somebody might say that they only did something because it would pursue profit, or they only did something because it was in their own self-interest. Or actually, that's not even true. It's just that in that situation, it's not felt to be appropriate to admit that actually your interest was a little bit less selfish or a little bit profiteering than you make it out to be.
We live in the age, however, of the sovereign individual. Maybe we've always lived in the age of the sovereign individual. Me and what I want and what I do is everything. The objective-subjective distinction, that duality, isn't that a little bit old hat? You seem to be happy with that.
I think that the notions of objectivity and subjectivity can be thought of in various ways. So the way you introduced it was in terms of sort of detaching from myself and seeing things from a broader point of view. There's nothing old hat about that. I mean, think about the effects of your behavior on the environment. You can think about that from the perspective of yourself right now in this room in the next 5 minutes, or you can think about yourself as an individual in 2023 as part of a long historical process of people like us doing certain kinds of things in universities. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it more objectively. That's just one way of thinking about the objective and the subjective. With respect to the sovereign individual, that's one of those great philosophical, politically, how can I put it?
Charged.
charged notions, which of course, at some level of or analysis, is a fiction. But it's a fiction that, in my opinion, which can be usefully mobilized to think about certain kinds of things, namely the value of individuals. In certain ways of thinking about the idea of the sovereign individual, I think it's a deeply problematic notion myself.
It's interesting because you mentioned earlier on high-powered executives. On a high-powered executive MBA, executive includes the Latin word sequi, which is sequence. Executives carry out, they sequence out things. It seems like you're a blocker. The philosophy is a blocker. Let me just carry stuff out. I don't need this stone in the shoe. I just need to carry something out.
Yeah, I think we will often be confronted by people who are very aware of, as it were, the institutional incentives and disincentives to stop and think or ask certain questions, right? Now, two things about that. The one thing is, of course, in my experience teaching these topics, most of the students who come to study with us have chosen to do so. Mm-hmm. So there are executives among them, but they have chosen to do so presumably because they've asked themselves those questions. So they're interested in thinking about, is it a blocker? What kind of blocker is it? When should I not worry about the blocker? When is it okay for me to ignore the blocker, et cetera, et cetera? So in some sense, we tend to speak to slightly easier audiences. Although I have to say, there have been years when some of the students have had rather more, as it were, practical concerns and have not been so interested in that aspect of the conversation. But going back to the very beginning of our conversation, even executives who consider certain types of fundamental philosophical problems as blockers, because they are ultimately wanting to do the jobs that they have chosen well, even they find themselves in situations where they have to apply the rules that they don't fundamentally want to reject. And applying a rule itself involves a certain element of judgment. You have to use your ethical sensibility to think, how do I apply this rule now? You know, as the British, of course, are famous about this. It's not just the British, but they are famous about this, which reminds me of when I was a student, and there was a rule in the college where I was a student, which said that, you know, all students had to wear formal attire when they went to see a college officer. This rule is not enforced.
Okay, is it a rule?
Yeah, it reminds me of I might be paraphrasing rather than quoting Wittgenstein, but. His dictum about rules, that whatever rule you give me, I'll give you a rule that justifies my use of your rule.
Well, that's a good one.
Sounds like Wittgenstein.
Could I just ask you, since we're talking about your current research, Halvard, and or not current research, but I suppose your interest and your angle at these philosophical questions. Your most recent book is an edited volume on the trolley problem. And when I saw it, I thought that's really interesting because the trolley problem, in a way, I mean, has come to be almost like a stereotypical thought experiment that's taught to every starting PhD, every starting philosophy student. And is there anything new to say about this? And so I was really interested to see that there is a 2023 volume on this, and I really wanted to ask you about this. So could you maybe just say a little bit about what the trolley problem is for our audience as well, but also what are the current debates and what is the current thinking about it?
Well, okay, so the trolley problem is a problem about choosing in a tragic or difficult situation where no matter what you do, somebody will be harmed. In the classic scenario, it's about saving lives. There's a set of situations where you can save more lives by causing other people to die. And the problem arises because there are situations in which it might be easy to say that you should always save the greatest number of lives, or you should cause as few deaths as possible. But there are other situations where the numbers are the same, and you say the opposite.
Can you give us
So
an
you're faced
example?
with something like, not like an aporia, but you're faced with the situation of having to explain why is it that in one situation it's okay for me to cause the death of one to save five, and in another situation it's not okay. What is it? What assumptions, what ethical assumptions do we bring to bear trying to explain why we behave this way in this situation and this way in another situation? So sometimes the trolley problem is used in teaching to confront people with these puzzles and to ask the students or ourselves whether we can find a coherent way to think ourselves out of them, to find a coherent way to explain what's the difference between these cases. So it's really at the very abstract level a challenge about what's a morally relevant difference and how does it work. With respect to the question of where the research is now, I mean, one of the interesting things about this, from the point of view of the history of the discipline, is that this was discussed primarily by philosophers after the introduction of this particular dilemma in the late 1960s, incidentally, in the context of a public discussion about the morality and legalization of abortion. That's where it first was introduced
In the UK, isn't it? Yeah.
in the UK.
Yeah.
Now, what happened was that for a few decades, it was mainly discussed by philosophers in a way that your question suggests. They just went round and round and round, as you might say. But what then happened was that it was picked up outside of philosophy, including in psychology, where these kinds of vignettes and very simple schematic challenges were used to try to understand what the psychological mechanisms are that operate in our minds when we make practical decisions. So in some sense, the topic became an interdisciplinary research program without ever having, as it were, intended to be such. So one of the things that was interesting to me, looking back on it after about 50 years, was what happens when you try to bring these discussions together, and what do we actually learn about our moral sensibility when we think about these different ways in which A, we learn something about ourselves by thinking about these examples or these vignettes, but also we're trying to find out something about, as it were, what the right thing to do is by thinking about these vignettes. For me, therefore, the question was, and of course that's a very personal thing, whether this is something that should be deeply disturbing to us, that there are these cases, very simple cases that you can confront people with, which seem to present us with situations where we have nothing to say, because there's a sense in which we feel kind of clueless very quickly.
Could
But at the
you
same time, but at the same time, this is
yeah,
very
go ahead,
important too.
yeah.
At the same time, it does not thereby undermine the courage of our convictions completely about being able to make certain type of ethical decisions. So we need to find some kind of balance between, oh, here are these difficult cases that we don't know what to do with. Here are some cases we definitely do know how to do with. And how are we going to, is there a way for us to articulate a coherent way of thinking about our ethical sensibility in light of thinking about these cases? And it's a difficult question. And I don't think that even though people have been thinking about it for 50 years, the general questions that it arises will stop anytime soon.
So I was going to say, could you give us an example of where that dynamic might be at play, where these different and difficult considerations might arise?
Well, so there are I mean, there was one which I don't really want to go into because it's because it quickly gets us down a track which might quickly become tasteless. But one example where people are using these kinds of scenarios is when they design protocols for the ethics of killing in war. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a slightly less problematic example would be the example of whether we can use vignettes or structural examples of this nature to articulate what kind of design we should have when we automate certain kinds of protocols for how machines behave, such as driverless cars or robots that move us around. So there is a literature at the moment, it's quite lively literature, about suppose you want to think about what kind of algorithms should be embodied in cars that no longer are driven by people. What kind of decisions should the cars make? And at what point do you, for example, insist that there should be a manual override so that that a person takes back control of what happens to the car? To what extent do you outsource, as it were, the decisions that the cars make in situations of risk where people's lives, for example, or people's healths might be at stake?
Like, for example, if the car, quote unquote, if the car needs to decide whether to sacrifice the passenger or the pedestrian or a number of pedestrians, or am I thinking in the right direction here?
Yeah, exactly. That's what the current literature is about. And some people think that some of the examples and some of the theory that the philosophers have been able to articulate can help us to think more clearly about those things. But of course, there is no simple application of the theory to practice, because you have all the complications of the law, how the machines work, and so on and so forth. Not a topic on which I'm an expert, but it's quite clear that these kinds of vignettes, which looked kind of trivial and maybe it was sort of irresponsible in the abstract, actually have some use to think about some real world cases.
However, why is it that philosophy is so hard? Listening to you talking, goodness me, this is really hard. What are some of the misconceptions that the general public or the business community have about philosophy?
Well, I think one of the things that I often come across is the idea that what the philosophers have is a set of, or what the philosophers should aspire to have is a set of theories which can be applied, as it were, directly to the world, so as to use a word of a former colleague, so as to give us an autopilot for life. and to the extent that the philosophers struggle with the possibility of finding an autopilot for life, philosophy has a problem and is something we should be suspicious of. So I think the possibility of coming up with an autopilot for life, I think that is something one should be skeptical about, not just in practice, but also, I think, as it were, ethically and philosophically. There's something very dubious about the idea that we should even aspire to that thing.
But it sounds like...
So what we do...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What we do as philosophers is we try to come up with ways of thinking more intelligently about questions that we admit are very difficult, even if we don't believe that the end result of our thinking or discussion is to come up with an autopilot for life.
So it sounds like you believe that you can cultivate a taste for philosophy, a kind of habit, a judgment. It sounds like that's what you're recommending.
Yeah, so I'm an optimist in the following sense. I think that it's possible to think more intelligently about difficult problems in the context of knowing that we're fallible, in the context of knowing that there's not always perhaps a single right answer, that we might make decisions that we have to live with, even though if we think about them later, we would have made a different decision. But nevertheless, there are lots of really stupid decisions that we can avoid. And sometimes thinking philosophically about the problems, we'll make less stupid decisions.
So what do you think is the main principle of philosophy, especially the principle that could be applied and transferred to other fields? Is it reason? Is it doubt? Is it debate?
The idea of being critical and self-reflective is ultimately the one thing that I bring to the table when I think about what philosophy has to offer. But I'm not an essentialist about philosophy, what philosophy is. I don't think it does just one thing. And when someone does something slightly different and call themselves a philosopher, that's just fine by me. I don't think I want to spend my life arguing about who owns that label.
So you wouldn't police the discipline?
No, that's not my style. I mean, I do realize that there are people who do that. In fact, I've had colleagues who like to do that. But that's just, I think that certainly is something that has had its time. But of course, we work in institutions. We are, of course, also professionals. And so sometimes to have the definitional power is a way to get hold of the resources. And so you can see that there's definitely incentive to have a long discussion about philosophy, what philosophy really is.
It just reminded me of a very famous paper in management, which is called Umbrella Advocates versus Validity Police. And it's about two different groups of people. So people who tend to say, well, no, this is a broad umbrella and we can have multiple conversations under it. Or no, what is this concept? And, you know, kind of policing the validity of it. But that's by the by anyway. Toby, sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up.
Go ahead,
Halvard. Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Okay, back to Toby then.
Well, I was going to say, you've seen this field, the applying or the practical philosophy, you've seen this over the years. You seem to have a real interest in that area. How have you seen that develop over the years, assuming it has?
I see that, our contribution as philosophers to these questions in general, I think we should be modest about what we were able to achieve. What I see more than what's being achieved is I see that there is the what I called earlier the philosophical toolkit that is used sometimes quite usefully, but in different areas at different times. So when I started out as a philosopher, as I said earlier, the big thing was the genome. I think philosophers have made some interesting contributions to the discussion, the general societal discussion about how we should think about issues to do with a knowledge of genetic and a mastery of genetic technologies. More recently, or actually in the present, there's a lot of talk about machines, machine intelligence, artificial intelligence. I can see the same kind of toolkit being applied slowly by philosophers to that topic. I don't think the philosophers will, you know, own those questions because they're complicated questions. They're sociological questions, historical questions, scientific questions, political questions, legal questions. But I think philosophy has a role to play in those. So I think about it, I guess, in terms of making a contribution to different things at different times, sometimes helpfully and sometimes notoriously not so helpfully.
I think I certainly see an explosion of interest in philosophy in general on the part of the general public, lay people like myself, for example, in the sense that you now see philosophy books on the self-help sections of bookstores, you have philosophy podcasts, you have different programs introducing philosophy. So I think to me it seems like there is a more general interest in the philosophical ideas and concepts in the broader society. Does that match what you see as well?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think there's certainly a lot of talk, but I think it depends a little bit on the reputation that a certain contribution makes at a certain time. So there are certain examples of philosophers in the public realm that have been that can be used to sort of defend your view. I think the recent influence, for better or for worse, of something like effective altruism, the effective mm-hmm. altruism movement, mm-hmm. is a good example of how something that started as a philosophically theoretical project has become public. And some people think that's a great thing, and some people think, oh, well, look what happened there. Terrible thing. What I think is more problematic in terms of justifying that hypothesis is that I think there's an interest in the questions, but there's not necessarily so much patience in thinking about going deeply into those questions in the way that we would like to do as philosophers.
That is certainly true.
Wittgenstein is allegedly someone who said that the motto of the philosophers should be "take your time." And if taking your time is something that is important in philosophy, then I think there's a sense in which the world we live in now is not philosophy friendly, because it wants headlines, it wants snappy things, it wants 1.5 minutes on YouTube. And actually to go and spend a lot of time going deeply into some material to try and understand it from more than one direction in its historical context, that's something that there's not almost so much patience for, even in universities, where more and more of the stuff that we're supposed to be delivering is little packets of information that can be sort of uploaded on Moodle or some other online service, where it has to be able to be absorbed by a student in 25 minutes because no one can pay attention for longer than that. I think that's not a very philosophical way of thinking about the world, it seems to me.
So philosophy is hard. People have no time. For those that are watching this video and have gotten this far, congratulations. What would your advice be if they've got a little whiff of, you know what, there's something in this? What should they do?
I think Wittgenstein's advice is a very good one. Take your time. Yeah, you have to find a place to concentrate on the question you're dealing with, in some sense abstracted away from the run-of-the-mill stuff you do every day, before you go back and apply it. I think there's a sense in which I sometimes see this in classes when you try to introduce students to something that is conceptually quite complicated, because they are busy people, or we're all busy people, the thought is, can you just give me the answer? Can you just give me the
gist?
Deliver the package so I can put it into my work.
Arrive at your point. Work
and solve my problem. And as an ethicist, it's very difficult to respond to that, because of course you'd like to help. But, you know, I think of the ethos of what I do is I will try to help you to do your thinking. Then you will have to decide for yourself what you want to do. And so the idea of you not doing the thinking is the one that I need to resist. And doing the thinking requires time.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's almost like insisting on an instrumental value of philosophy destroys the very value of philosophy.
Yeah, there is. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Yeah.
Interesting. I suppose kind of thinking about the future a little bit more, where do you see your own work going? What are you thinking of at the moment? What are you reading? What's on your intellectual radar screen?
My work recently has been on a topic which is related to ethics and business, but not primarily in it. It's about questions about responsibility for our role in processes, structures, institutions that transcend us. Partly in ways where we are either holding ourselves responsible, holding other people responsible, asking ourselves whether we should take responsibility for things which are not primarily of our own doing, and how that affects how we not only criticize people, but how we praise people. I'm primarily interested in the concept of praise and the idea that there is an ethics of praising well and badly. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how that relates to, as it were, how we operate as individuals, things that are or are not within our control, in ways that challenge what Toby earlier referred to as the notion of the sovereign individual.
So what would be some of the dilemmas and thorny questions in that debate?
Well, so let's take a simple example. You have two people who are perfectly well trained. There may be let's say they're rescuers on a beach. They're there. Their job is to help people who are in danger of drowning. One is on one side of the beach. The other is on the other side of the beach. There's one person drowning on the left-hand side of the beach. The person on the left-hand side of the beach, the rescuer, goes out and rescues them. Everybody's really grateful. They get a prize. They get lots of praise. Does a lot of good things for them. The other guy on the other, or doesn't have to be a guy, on the other side of the beach, was ready just to help the person as well. It's just that they had the bad luck of there being no one drowning next to them. They don't get the prize. They don't get the same kind of praise. Mm. Is there something unfair about that? You think about what the life chances of these people might be. They both had the same intentions. They were well-intentioned. They were good people. It's just that the performance aspect of one person was different from the other person's. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that there's necessarily a deep skeptical puzzle here. I'm not saying that we should not be grateful for the person who rescued the person on the left-hand side of the beach. But it's worth thinking about as a way of getting into the question about, you know, to what extent do you think that people's rewards should necessarily be indexed to what they actually have done? Mm. The relevance of that, of course, to business is very clear, because people get rewarded in business for outcomes, which in many cases is at least partly due to them just being in the right place at the right time.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And my background in business, of course, is not just strategy, but also performance measurement, which comes with all of the conversations about incentives, compensation, bonuses, and things like this. And I completely agree with you. I mean, even in your scenario, I can think about other implications of, for example, the rescuer on the right side now beginning to wish that, well, somebody would be drowning on the right side now. And is that something we want people to wish?
Yeah, so there is a negative incentive for people who were not fortunate enough to rescue to generate some emergency or something that makes them look indispensable, so that they can also, get the reward. I can see this could go on for quite some time.
yeah, absolutely.
And it would seem applicable not just in a seminar room, but in a boardroom too. That conversation seems just as relevant.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I was recently on a committee that was actually deciding on rewards within an institution. And some of the discussions that did come up clearly did boil down to this question about, you know, it was the luck of so-and-so to have been there at this particular time. But of course, that allowed them to be able to use that as a way to justify that they were doing well in the institution. And vice versa. Mm.
I have one sort of final general question, but Toby, do you have...
No, you go ahead.
I suppose this is more of a speculative question, but taking this back to the conversation about ethics in business, what sort of biggest ethical challenges do you see leaders facing in the foreseeable future, in the next 10 years? What's really on the horizon?
Well, I think this is not really a philosophical question. This is a question about how I understand, as it were, where our society is at this particular point in time.
Indeed.
So I can be more or less subversive. I'll try and pick something in the middle to keep the conversation light. I think that one of the big issues at the moment is that we have private organizations, some of which are profit-making, that are extremely powerful. They're international. Their power extends in some ways much further than many states. They are more powerful than many states. They have power over many states. And I think a big challenge for people who run those institutions and people who deal with those institutions is how to think about what is the moral or ethical agency of these institutions and the people within them. Should we think of them more like we think about the leaders that we call politicians? Or should we think of them as something separate? And if these distinctions, which theoretically have often been very sharply made, if they get blurred, do we have a way of dealing with those ethical challenges that doesn't, as it were, subvert some of the basic values that we use to justify how we run our societies, right? Should we think of the owners of the great multinational corporations as our new kings or queens? or should we think about them some other way? I don't think we have a good answer to those questions at the moment as a society, and I think that that's a vital thing to think about in the next, in the coming, not just the coming years, but probably for a very long time.
Mm. Toby?
Well, no, I've got a final abstract question. Confucius or John Stuart Mill? Which to choose?
That's a very good question. I've been reading some Confucius recently. That's why it's such a hard question for me to answer. And I haven't read John Stuart Mill for a long time, although I did read a lot of John Stuart Mill. I don't know. Can we have both?
Yes, on the desert island you can have both, and you were taking your time there, which is fantastic to see. You're demonstrating what it is that philosophers should do.
Taking the time.
Taking the time. Wow.
I suppose final question, and maybe you've already answered it by saying that sort of the dictum of philosophy is take your time. But if there was for our audience, if there was some one thing that some practical thing that they could do to really feel or experience the value of philosophy, the practical value of philosophy, what would you recommend they do, other than taking the time
and reading your book?
Are you thinking, for example, of one of the students in your business ethics classes,
or even one of the students who's already graduated and is out there making those decisions and living the world of practice?
Well, maybe I'll present them with the challenge, which is the challenge that I faced very early on as an adult when I decided that I was going to spend more of my time than is strictly speaking healthy to do philosophy, which is consider an opinion you hold firmly, something that you believe is important. Ask yourself what reasons you could give for holding that opinion. Confront it with some objections and criticism and see how long it holds up. Should that disturb you? I think it's very difficult, if you do that honestly, not to think that there's something interesting to go on thinking about at that point.
Fantastic.
Good answer.
Well, Halvard, this was for us, on our side, this was a fantastic conversation. We really learned a lot and really enjoyed it, I think, which is more important in a way. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing your ideas and insights.
Halvard, thank you. I'm going to read Confucius.
Good. Great speaking to you.
And my head is hurting, so thank you for that.
Okay,
thank you very
good.
Much.